is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco for November 3, 2005. The Peace and Justice Center of Eastern Maine recently held their annual Harvest Supper and presented longtime peace activist Doug Allen with the Hands of Peace Award. We'll bring you coverage of that event, and later in the program, we'll have Eitan Thomas of the NBA speaking in Washington, D.C. in September, a speech that CommonDreams.org called the speech that everyone is talking about. We'll start with the Peace and Justice Hands of Peace Awards. The presenter is Mike Howard, presenting the award to Doug Allen, and Roxanne Mungsgaard is the MC.
I'd like to introduce the presenter of the Hands of Peace Award, Mike Howard. Mike is a long-time steering committee member of the Peace and Justice Center and the Education Committee. He has been in the philosophy department with the University of Maine at Orono for 25 years. Mike Howard was involved many, many years with the Maine Peace Action Committee, and it is my honor to present Mike Howard.
Thanks, Roxanne, and I want to thank Roxanne for doing such a wonderful job emceeing this evening. She's really brings a lot of energy to the role. When I first heard that my friend, colleague, and comrade Doug Allen had been chosen for this year's Hands of Peace Award, I thought, that can't be the Doug Allen I know. Surely, after 40 years of being in the leadership of peace and justice struggles, he would have already received this award, or at least one like it. But it's actually remarkable, if you look back over his history, over all these years, that he actually has not been recognized in this way. He got involved in the civil rights struggle when he was in at Vanderbilt University back in the 60s. When he moved on to Southern Illinois University, he led the anti-war movement there, challenging the USAID-funded Vietnamese Studies Center, and that struggle actually cost him his job. So he has learned early on what kind of price one may have to pay, and he's continued on in the struggle after that. He actually won an ACLU lawsuit against that university some years later, and was vindicated in that struggle. But by that time, he moved on to Maine, where in 1974, he helped to organize the Maine Peace Action Committee, which is one of the oldest, if not the oldest, continuing campus peace and justice group in the country. MPAC, over the years, has struggled against the war in Indochina, fought against nuclear weapons in the 1980s, opposed U.S. intervention in Central America, tried to stop the expansion of ROTC on campus, all through a variety of means that we're all familiar with, the putting together of a newsletter, bringing speakers to campus, bringing in political theater, and other means. One of the most remarkable struggles, in which Doug was absolutely in the leadership of, was the campaign to get the University of Maine to divest $3 million of its holdings and companies doing business in South Africa, and that happened in the 1980s. Doug went on to help found peace studies at the university, the Socialist and Marxist Studies program, which has put on roughly 300 programs over the last 15 years or so on campus. He helped to found the Peace and Justice Center in 1988 and has been on the Education Committee ever since. We regularly put together a film series, the acts that happen typically every spring, and demonstrations all too frequently against events that we wish would stop happening but that keep flooding in on us. He's also been a really impressive speaker and writer of many scholarly as well as popular articles on the Iraq War, the Vietnam War and its legacy, terrorism, Gandhi, and the importance of Gandhi for us today, and religion and politics, particularly in South Asia. What makes all of this activism truly remarkable is not only that Doug does all this while pursuing a full-time teaching and scholarly career, but his teaching and scholarly career is itself quite remarkable. I won't go through the long list of things if you were to see his curriculum vitae, but I'll just mention quickly that he's had Fulbright and Smithsonian grants to go to India. He's written 13 books, over 60 articles. He's received two of the most prestigious awards that the University of Maine can give to its faculty, the U.S. Presidential Research and Creative Achievement Award and the Distinguished Maine Professor Award. So he's put more energy than most professors do into his professorial career, and on top of that, he's found time for peace and justice activism, and not only that, enormous time for peace and justice activism. And what to me is particularly important, and how Doug has been a model for me in this regard, is that he struggled all the way along to integrate his scholarly and his teaching career with his activism. For example, doing research on Gandhi and then translating that into peace and justice activism, studying the work of Martin Luther King, putting that into his courses. And probably the most important influence on Doug has been Marx. Of all of the thinkers over the last 150 years, the work of Groucho has probably influenced Doug more than anybody else. Now, I'd like to wrap it up with a few personal reflections that will probably resonate with a lot of you from your own personal experiences with Doug. I came to Maine in 1981, and before that, I was never really an activist. You know, I'd show up for the occasional demonstration. I participated in a strike at BU, but I was never the organizer. Still, I'd spent 7 years studying radical social philosophy, and I was dedicated to research that would promote social justice. But, of course, there are many people like that who never do anything but scholarship. When I moved to Maine, Doug provided the ideal mentor, friend, and supporter for a life of activism as well. And one of the most important things that he did was to make the philosophy department at the University of Maine a safe haven for radical critique and activism. It's frankly rather easy to be a social critic, but it's not so easy to be an activist. And Doug's own experience at Southern Illinois is a good evidence of that. When I got to Maine, Doug invited me to join the Maine Peace Action Committee, and there I learned things like, you know, how to put a newsletter together, how to navigate through student government politics, how to write a grant proposal, how to put together a flyer, how to set up publicity. All of these things are sort of nuts and bolts issues that a lot of us take for granted, but you have to learn it from somebody, and you can't just expect that somebody else is going to do it. And Doug doesn't just expect that somebody else is going to do it either. He does all that work himself, he always has, and he's continuing to do it. Before long, I found that I myself was one of the main faculty working on the Maine Nuclear Freeze campaign, going to statewide meetings, organizing conferences, writing grant proposals, and actually trying to translate some of this into some scholarly work as well. Now, I tell all this about myself, not to be talking about myself, because this kind of experience didn't just happen to me, it's happened to scores of people, and I think some of them are here in this room, that have gone through IMPACT, you know, showed up at the University of Maine campus as a shy kid from a small town in Maine or a small town in Kansas, and then 2 or 3 years later, you've become an organizer. And how is it that he does that? What are Doug's special ingredients? I'll just mention some of them. I'm sure people could add others. A sense of humor. Everybody who knows Doug has experienced his sense of humor, and I can't underemphasize how important that is to keep people going and avoid burnout in all of the frustrations that you encounter working for peace and justice. Secondly, a high standard for analysis. Doug will not settle for sloppy thinking. Thirdly, an indomitable optimism. We actually face two enemies in this world. One is the system of militarism and exploitation and injustice that we're all working against. And the second is our own cynicism and feelings of powerlessness. And I think you probably have all experienced some meeting or conversation where things take a sour turn and people are starting to get depressed and say, what's the use? We can't get anywhere. And then you can always count on Doug to step in and give you another way to look at it so that you can feel positive. And this brings me to the fourth thing about Doug, and that is a continuing recognition that we aren't working alone. Doug exhibits this understanding through a generous appreciation of other people, of what they contribute. He's always pointing this out, nominating people for awards, encouraging people, and, you know, acknowledging that they too are contributing, even if it's just in a small way. And secondly, by showing support and solidarity. Doug will go to meetings or talks where perhaps, you know, what's to be heard there is something that won't be anything new for him, but he'll go just to show support and solidarity. So I think it's very fitting tonight, and I'm in fact very honored to be able to participate in the opportunity to recognize Doug himself for all the work that he's done for us and for peace and justice.
Those of you who know me know that I am a man of few words. Good. I'm glad I didn't have to say laugh. Someone did point out to me recently that there is a punctuation mark known as a period. And when you come to a period, it means stop. And I think this is just a rumor. And I think it may be the period conspiracy of Karl Rove to try to get the peace and justice people to stop, but we won't be deterred. And I think, as Mike said, I found that humor is important. In my early childhood, I found that humor was very important in dealing with a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism. And then throughout my peace and justice activist life for over 40 years, I find that humor has been very important for me in sustaining the struggle. I find that humor serves the purpose of both demystifying and disempowering people who exploit and oppress others. And it's also good to learn how to laugh at yourself, because often it gives you a perspective and a release and allows you to sustain a struggle. And those of us who are involved in peace and justice work know that we're dealing with a lot of suffering, a lot of pain, and humor often is one of many ways that allows us to continue and to endure and to succeed. When I first heard quite recently that I was going to be given this Hands of Peace Award, I was surprised, and then I actually tried to undo it. And the reason, it was not that I was unappreciative, but I just felt that there's so many wonderful peace and justice activists in our community who do such good work, and there's so many other people who deserve the award. But I was told it was too late. And so I do want to indicate that I am deeply touched. Those of you, in fact, who have observed my psychological states and bizarre behavior know I am deeply touched. He also liked that comment. She's out of control. Fortunately, the committee was very wise, and they scheduled an excellent speaker, Russ Libby, who will talk. So one of the benefits of that is that it will really limit what I will say. I would love to talk about peace and justice, activism, the challenges and joys of being a peace and justice activist, but I'll only make one general observation and then stop. I found from actually an early age that human beings have many human needs, and the need for to live a meaningful life, to develop as human beings and live a meaningful life. And there are many human needs we have. We all recognize, and they're fulfilled in different ways. We all have the need for air. We all have the need for water. And if it's clean air and clean water, then in fact we can develop a fuller human life. As Russ will talk about, we have the need for healthy, nutritious, sustaining food. We have the need for shelter, for clothes. We have the need for a safe, sustainable environment. We have the need for language and communication. Human beings who cannot express their emotions, their feelings, their passions, their thoughts, their values. We know their human development is severely stunted. In addition to all of these basic human needs, that does not make a full human life. We have many, many other human needs that are necessary for our development. And for myself, I found personally that peace and justice, activist work, was a way of my developing myself as a human being and fulfilling some basic human needs. And I found that part of that involved coming to terms with the term struggle. For example, at an early age, I lived in India, and I was immersed in Hinduism and Buddhism and many forms that indicated that struggle was negative. And what one aimed for was a kind of inner peace, free from struggle. And that's very appealing. But for me personally, I found, especially when you saw the suffering of others and you could do something about it, if for me personally, it was a rather narcissistic and rather selfish path. I found, to me, struggle is a good word, but not all struggle is good. Most of humankind lives under conditions where it's a struggle just to survive in terms of those basic human needs that I mentioned. And they live under conditions of necessity and suffering caused by other human beings. And there's nothing good about that. In fact, no one on this planet should have to live such a life of pain and suffering when, in fact, we could alleviate it. But there's another kind of suffering as seen in peace and justice activism that I find is ennobling. It's a way of living with dignity. It's a way of living a life of values that one can be proud of, right? It's a way of living a life of meaning and of depth. It's a way of establishing meaningful relations with other human beings, establishing a meaningful sense of community, okay? And what I have found in my own view of what it is to be human as a self, it's a relational view. There is no self without others. And the others are part of who one is as a human being. So, and what I found is that when you relate to others who are suffering, and when you relate to other peace and justice activists, it provides you with wonderful opportunities for developing as a human being, for realizing your humanity, for living a meaningful life. So what I'd like to do is I want to thank all of you. I'm very appreciative and thankful for the award, but even more so, I'm thankful for all of you as peace and justice others who have given me the opportunity to live a life of challenge, of creativity, and of meaning. Thank you very much.
That was Doug Allen accepting the Hands of Peace Award that was presented to him at the Peace and Justice Center of Eastern Maine's Harvest Supper recently. And next, we are about to hear what Common Dreams has called the speech everyone is talking about, the NBA's Eaton Thomas, who spoke at the Peace Rally in Washington, D.C. in September.
Good afternoon. Giving all honor, thanks, and praises to God for courage and wisdom. This is a very important rally. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to share my thoughts, feelings, and concerns regarding a tremendous problem that we are currently facing. This problem is universal, transcending race, economic background, religion, and culture. And this problem is none other than the current administration, which has set up shop in the White House. In fact, I'd like to take some of these cats on a field trip. I want to get a big yellow buses with no air conditioner and no seatbelts and round up Bill O'Reilly, Pat Buchanan, Trent Lott, Sean Hannity, Dick Cheney, Jeb Bush, Bush Jr. and Bush Sr., John Ashcroft, Giuliani, Ed Gillespie, Catherine Harris, that little bow-tie Tucker Carlson, and any other right-wing conservative Republicans I could think of. And take them all on a trip to the hood. Not to do no 30-minute documentary. I mean, I want to drop them off and leave them there. Let them become one with the other side of the tracks. Get them four mouths to feed and no welfare. Have scare tactics run through them like a laxative, criticizing them for needing assistance. I'd show them working families that make too much to receive welfare, but not enough to make ends meet. I'd employ them with jobs with little security. Let them know how it feels to be an employee at will, able to be fired at the drop of a hat. I'd take away their opportunities, then try their children as adults, sending their 13-year-old babies to life in prison. I'd sell them dreams of hopelessness while spoon-feeding their young with the daily dose of inferior education. I tell them no child shall be left behind, then take more money out of their schools. Tell them to show and prove themselves on standardized exams, testing their knowledge on things that they haven't been taught, and then I'd call them inferior. I'd soak into their interior notions of endless possibilities. I'd paint pictures of assisted productivity if they only agree to be all they can be. Dress them up with fatigues and boots with promises of pots of gold at the end of rainbows. Free education awaits to rain on those who finish their bid. Then I'd close the lid on that barrel of fool's gold by starting a war. Sending their children into the midst of a hostile situation. And while they're worried about their babies being murdered and slain in foreign lands, I'd grace them with the pain of being sick and unable to get medicine. Give them health benefits that barely cover the common cold. John Q would become their reality as HMOs introduce them to the world of inferior care. Filling their lungs with inadequate air, penny-pinching at the expense of patients, doctors practicing medicine in an intricate web of rationing and regulations. Patients wonder the maze of managed bureaucracy. Costs rise and quality quickly deteriorates, but they say that managed care is cheaper. They'll say that free choice in medicine will defeat the overall productivity. And as co-payments are steadily rising, I'll make their grandparents have to choose between buying their medicine and paying their rent. Then, I'd feed them hypocritical lines of being pro-life as the only Christian way to be. Then, very contradictingly, I'd fight for the spread of the death penalty as if thou shalt not kill applies to babies but not to criminals. Then, I'd introduce them to those sworn to protect and serve, creating a curve in their trust in the law. I'd show them the nightsticks and plungers, the pepper spray and stun guns, the mace and magnum that they'll soon be coming acquainted with, the shakedowns and illegal search and seizures, the planted evidence of being stopped for no reason, harassment ain't even the half of it, 41 shots to two raised hands, cell phones and wallets that are confused with illegal contrabands. I'd introduce them to pigs who love making their guns click like wine glasses. Yeah! Woo! Everlasting targets surrounded by bullets, making them a walking bullseye, a living piñata, held at the mercy of police brutality. And then we'll see if they finally weren't aware of the truth. If their eyes weren't finally opened like a box of Pandora, I'd show them how the other side of the tracks carries the weight of the world on our shoulders and how society seems to be holding us down with the force of a boulder. The bird of democracy flew the coop back in Florida. democracy for some. And justice comes in packs like wolves in sheep's clothing. TKO'd by the right hooks of life, many are left staggering under the weight of the day, leaning against the ropes of hope. When your dreams have fallen on barren ground, it becomes difficult to keep pushing yourself forward like a train. Administering pain like a doctor with a needle, their sequels continue more lethal than injections, and they keep telling us all is equal. I tell them that instead of giving tax breaks to the rich, financing corporate mergers, and leading us into unnecessary wars and under-the-table dealings with Enron and Halliburton, maybe they could work on making society more peaceful. Instead, they take more and more money out of inner city schools, give up on the idea of rehabilitation, and build more prisons for poor people. With unemployment continuing to rise like a deficit, it's no wonder why so many think that crime pays. Maybe this trip will make them see the error of their ways. Or maybe next time, we'll just all get out and vote. And as far as their stay in the White House, tell them that numbered are their days.
Etaan Thomas of the Washington Wizards. Give it up.
That was basketball player Etaan Thomas at the ceasefire concert in Washington, D.C., September 24, 2005. Earlier that day, an estimated 150,000 to 300,000 people marched on the White House to express opposition to the ongoing war and occupation in Iraq.
The keynote speech at the Peace and Justice Harvest Supper was given by Russ Libby of Maine Organic Farmers and Gardeners Association, as you may have heard mentioned earlier in today's program. That speech will be featured on Voices on Wednesday, November 9th at 4. And you've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco. We'd like to thank Matt Murphy for contributing audio from the Harvest Supper. You can reach us here at WERU or by emailing radioactive@mainindymedia.org. Our website is radioactivenews.org, and you can download shows there or subscribe to podcasting. Thanks for listening and acting, and please join us again next week, Thursday at 4 for Radioactive.